This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. Today I have in studios with me Datuk Dr. Ahmad Faizal Mohamed Perdaus, President of Mercy Malaysia, one of the foremost NGOs in the country providing emergency medical relief both here and abroad. Thank you for speaking with us today, Datuk.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you.
So Mercy Malaysia, the perception, I believe, is that you operate mainly internationally, but actually you also do a lot of good work here in Malaysia. So, for example, you've worked in flood mitigation, you've done work with Kuala Krai, I believe, as well as extensive work in East Malaysia. Why don't you tell us a bit about those operations, first of all?
So, first of all, Mercy Malaysia is 20 years old this year. And in those 20 years, we've actually worked in Malaysia about as much as we've worked internationally. The amount of work that we do in Malaysia actually represents about 50% of our workload on an annual basis. I must say, however, that up till today, that does not commensurate with the amount of funding that is made available for our Malaysian operations.
So you receive a lot less funding for Malaysia than you do for overseas?
Yes, and that's probably logical for the most part, because the overseas operations require a lot more in terms of logistics. In Malaysia, we do four main things. One is disaster mitigation and preparedness, disaster risk reduction, from advocacy to learning to as well as to implementing programs on the ground with communities as well as with other agencies. The second bit, which is related to that and which has come about since 2016, is we're also involved in what's called building resilient communities. Mm. Now, this is part of disaster preparedness and risk reduction, but it extends beyond that. It extends beyond that and it can also be applied to other sorts of hazardous situations. An example of which, of course, is the recent Pasir Gudang hazard, which is actually very much man-made and is actually chemical plus a little bit of climate change driven in nature. The third thing that we do is we do a lot of work with vulnerable communities in the hinterland of Malaysia, both here in the peninsula as well as in Sabah and Sarawak. These programs at the moment are mainly medical in nature. However, since the big Kelantan floods of 2014-15, we've also added a new facet to it, which is a large-scale water sanitation and hygiene programs. Mm. You'd be surprised to know that there are still places in the hinterland of Malaysia without adequate supply of clean water. The fourth area of work which we do in Malaysia is with vulnerable communities who are not Malaysians, but they are people who are refugees or asylum seekers or stateless people. And the majority of the work we do in the peninsula concerns our work with the Rohingya community, Rohingya refugees, as well as in Sabah with the stateless people, especially from the Philippines.
We have seen a lot of mixed reports coming out of the treatment of Rohingya refugees, particularly here in Malaysia. Some say they've been badly treated. Other accounts say the situation is overhyped. Can you give us more of a realistic accounting of what is happening with the Rohingya refugees in Malaysia?
Well, let's put it this way, Lynn. If we were to be honest about it, their situation is dire. Hmm. Because while all refugees are in need, regardless of which community and regardless of which country they come from, however, with the Rohingyas, as opposed to the other refugee communities, they are much, much more affected simply because for the last 20 to 30 years, they have been deprived in their own homeland of basic necessities, basic access to education, basic access to healthcare, and also basic access to proper employment, even in their own country. This means that most of them do not have education up to the secondary level. Very, very few, if any, have tertiary education at all. And to make it worse, because of the lack of access to employment where they came from, most of the Rohingya only are able to do very basic village level type of work. So this means that when they come here, most of them are in a situation where they are not able to fend for themselves. However, We must give credit where it's due. Despite the fact that Malaysia is not a signatory to the Geneva Conventions, for the last 20 years, Malaysia has been relatively kind to refugees, especially to the Rohingya. And
on a relative basis.
On a relative basis, meaning that they are allowed to be here. There's no refoulement. They are not sent back, yeah? At least not on a large-scale basis, yeah? For the most part, they are involved in our non-formal economy. And most of them do not have formal employment. And this adds another level of difficulty for them. A good example would be if a Rohingya family has a mother or a wife who is pregnant. They're not allowed to gain access to formal government healthcare facilities, except if they pay first-class foreigners rates. At the moment, those with UNHCR cards, which is the majority of them, hopefully, are given a 50% discount. But even that is a lot of money for them. And so we are very hopeful that in the next few months, going into late this year and next year, with funding from the Qatari government, we hope that NGOs like Mercy Malaysia, working in concert together with the Qataris and the Malaysian government, will be able to provide some relief to the Rohingya refugees, especially in the areas of health and healthcare.
So what's the status of discussions then with the Qatari government for that injection of funds? Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Right. The Qatari government actually made a commitment 3 years ago, mm-hmm. Verbally, to support the Rohingya refugee community here in Malaysia.
Mm.
And the Qatari government, through the Qatar Development Fund, then had a series of meetings with the Malaysian government then. And an amount was promised and allocated. At that time, it was the amount mentioned was $50 million to be spent over a certain number of years. The negotiations and the discussions went on 2017, right up till 2018, between the two governments. But it was only after the last general elections that the Qataris came back with a little bit more vigor, if I may add. And over the last 1 year, there's been a lot of activity on this issue. And we are now at a stage where the first part of this funding is now ready to be disbursed and utilized. And the processes have taken place. The selection of the NGO partners have also taken place. And we should see healthcare. Initially, there were six areas where the funding was supposed to support. Now there are three: healthcare, education, and livelihoods, and which includes training for livelihoods. And we should see the healthcare portion roll out very soon. And Mercy Malaysia is very much involved in the healthcare portion.
So, considering that you receive funding from governments, and I understand that this is not a situation unique to Mercy Malaysia, this is something that we do see in other charitable organizations and NGOs around the world. How independent, though, are you of a political influence?
Mercy Malaysia has always maintained a very apolitical stance. And this is a stance which we have jealously and religiously guarded over the last 20 years. Might I say here, since this is BFM, that prior to the 2008 general elections, we had a very conservative and very, very careful approach in our dealings with the government, especially the federal government, but also with the state governments. After the 2008 elections, where the country moved into a sort of a two-party system, yeah, in parliament as well as throughout the country, Mercy Malaysia became a little bit more comfortable in making our apolitical stance known and very public. And we continued to work with any government of the day, both in Malaysia as well as abroad where we work, regardless of their political leanings or affiliations.
So have you seen a change in the operating environment, for example, since GE14?
We have. And thankfully, it's been positive. It's been more open. the environment generally for civil society is wider, and Mercy Malaysia, of course, benefits from this, and we our engagement with the government now is even more mature than it was before. But even before, for example, when during floods in Malaysia, and floods will happen in Kelantan, yes?
Mm.
And Kelantan, of course, has always been ruled separately from the federal government, even now, yes? And Mercy Malaysia has no issues, no problems working with both the Kelantanese state authorities as well as federal government when the federal government gets involved.
I'm speaking with Datuk Dr. Ahmad Faizal Mohamed Perdaus, President of Mercy Malaysia. After this, we'll be taking a look at the organisation's donation incomes and some of its financials, so be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Datuk Dr. Ahmad Faizal Mohamed Perdaus, President of Mercy Malaysia. Earlier, Datuk, we were talking a little bit about Mercy's mandate. But now let's also take a look at the organization's financials. Because taking a look at your books, Datuk, Mercy has got a very volatile track record when it comes to funding. Why is that?
So since 2003, we've had a significant amount of funding that's come through. In fact, on average, over the last 20 years now, it's been about 10 to 12 million a year. Our funding pattern, however, has not changed very much. Although the portfolios, gladly, thankfully, mm-hmm. Have diversified better now. So we have four or five main portfolios of funding. Number one is the corporate sector in Malaysia. Number two is the general public in Malaysia. Number three are international aid funding. Yeah. Number four is the Malaysian government, whenever it sees fit. And number five are philanthropic foundations and individuals. These five are the major portfolios. Yeah. In the first years of Mercy Malaysia's professional life, which began somewhere in 03-04, the bulk of our funding, up to 70-80%, came from corporate Malaysia. And
but that's still the case, isn't it? Or at least private funding.
Private sector funding is still very, very big. Mm. Although it's dropped slightly from 70-80% to now about 60% on a yearly basis. However, we have managed to diversify into areas which we used not to get funding at all. So now we are beginning to get international aid funding over the last few years. We've begun to get funding from the UN system. Although it's still very small in percentage, we've also gotten funding now from other foundations and other governments apart from the Malaysian government. What has happened is that we see a pattern. What's remained the same is that Mercy Malaysia still very much depends on something happening before we get a major injection of funds. Now, we need to change that. And this is very important because otherwise, the only years that we will get good funding are the years when something very bad happens somewhere. For example, in the bumper year for most humanitarian organizations of 2005, just after the Indian Ocean tsunami and the tsunami and earthquake which hit Indonesia and Aceh, as well as Sri Lanka. And then there was an earthquake in Pakistan later in 05. That year, for example, Mercy Malaysia, despite being very small then, got about 30 million ringgit. But after that, you know, the next year and the next year, the funding level dropped drastically, like over a cliff. Now, in 2014 and 2015, we thought we had broken this pattern because for two successive years, we had received income of about
23 million ringgit. Presumably, that would have been the Nepal earthquake, flooding
Typhoon
here
Haiyan
in Malaysia.
Late 2013, flooding in Malaysia. There was a Gaza war in 14 as well. All that combined. Now, but we thought initially, oops, okay, looks like we're on our way. And this is good because then we are looking at building on this and perhaps reaching the next level, perhaps 30 million and so on and so forth. But to be honest, that didn't happen. And then we looked at it in retrospect and we found that, oops, you know, it's actually the same thing again, still event-driven. So we're back to our average now of about, you know, 15 million, 13 million ringgit a year. It's still good because it means that we are able to get that amount without having to have a major catastrophe happening. The last 2 years have been relatively quiet. There have been only moderate-sized earthquakes, for example, in Indonesia, yeah, in Lombok, in Palu. They're not super big, yeah, and responses were also limited, yeah. As well as there's not been a major flood in Malaysia since the 2015 one, in 2014-15 one. And there's no new major conflict. Of course, Mercy Malaysia is involved continuously in the conflicts in Syria, in Rakhine, Cox's Bazar, as well as on a smaller scale in Mindanao. But these are long-running, long-term conflicts, which after a while, donors get fatigued, people lose interest, yeah, and people don't even understand sometimes the complexities. The other angle is education and awareness again, to educate both the general public as well as donors, both corporate and government, that there is value in contributing to civil society as a whole, but especially to organizations who do work on a continuous basis, like Mercy Malaysia, like WWF, Malaysian Nature Society, etc., in other spheres as well, to allow these organizations then to be better at what they do, prepare better. And when something actually happens, we already have a certain reserve with which we can then spend immediately. So this level of understanding, however, I must say, will need some work still. Mm. And we're still very far away from, say, the most developed countries in Western Europe, whereby people do give on a continuous basis to charities, even if there was no major catastrophe happening.
Yes, and I guess this is reflected in your books, right? Because you have, when you talk about charitable funds that you receive, you have restricted funds which are channeled towards specific countries or specific events, and you have unrestricted funds. And it's this unrestricted funds that allows you to essentially parachute in your people in the event of an immediate emergency relief situation. And your unrestricted funds has also historically been much, much lower than the restricted funds that you receive. And is this so essentially due to the Malaysian culture at the end of the day?
It is so. And it's not just Malaysia, I must say. Mm-hmm. It's largely a lot of Asia, mostly. Yeah. In Africa, it's slightly different because most of the countries in Africa don't have an income level that will probably allow them to contribute in the first place. In Asia, it's more or less the understanding. Mm-hmm. And yes, you're right. It's the cultural aspect that, you know, we give when there is something happening. On the unrestricted and restricted funds, yes, the lack of unrestricted funds means that organizations like Mercy will have a slight difficulty, and sometimes we take risk.
You have wait times as
yes,
well, right?
Financial risk when we deploy immediately. Mm-hmm. But we do. And we use our reserves whenever there's a major emergency. But of course, that means that the amount of help and aid that we're able to give during that acute phase where lives can be saved will also be limited to a certain extent until we get more funds in. So that's number one. And secondly, of course, people forget that we have cost as well. Mm-hmm. And we have logistics costs, we have training costs, we have costs to upkeep our assets, like our equipment, etc., for our emergency response teams, for our logistics, for our water teams, etc. And we also have got headquarters operational costs, and we have to pay our staff, which are already volunteering in a way because they are being paid much less than what and how much they could be paid if they were actually working elsewhere in the corporate sector here in Malaysia. So we appreciate them very much, but we do need to pay them salaries. We are very open about this, and we are very transparent about it. There's no way we can do this work with volunteers alone. While we maintain a certain level of income, salaries, remunerations for our staff, we also make sure that the costs don't overrun. And we've encouraged, for example, people to take flexible hours to reduce the amount that we'll need to pay them for those who can. We've encouraged people also, where and when possible, to be parked directly under particular projects so that our HQ costs can be managed better and can be trimmed. We've also made certain logistics measures. Like, for example, we've moved office twice now in the last 5-6 years, simply because the cost of maintaining an office in central KL was becoming too much, and we had to move out to the suburbs. So these are some of the challenges facing us, but we'll work towards getting more unrestricted funds. We are looking very much to getting more funding in through two of our programs. One is a corporate payroll deduction program,
mm-hmm.
as well as the other one, which has been going on for the last few years, called Seringgit Sehari from the general public, trying to get people to contribute in a continuous way, unrestricted. But it's a challenge because, as you mentioned, there's still this perception battle that we have to win. The cultural aspect that we have to get over. People are not used to giving money without seeing an emergency or a catastrophe happening. Yes.
That's what you mentioned, Cox's Bazaar. And there have been some reports that your operations in Cox's Bazaar may be in trouble if funding doesn't pick up significantly over the next 2 years. So my question is, how sustainable is your operation there? Say, if you don't receive particular injections of funding into your operations in Cox's Bazaar, will you be able to continue operating there beyond, say, 2 years?
At the moment, we are able to operate fully as we are now, until 2020, mid-2020, so that's another year from now. In our line of work, of course, looking for funding is part and parcel of doing the work on the ground itself.
Mm.
And even as we speak, our team is busy sending out proposals, getting contacts with donors, partners, to see if there's any more funding line coming through. So basically, what we do, as we always do in most parts of the world where we work, which makes us very effective as compared to very much bigger organizations, is that we're quite flexible in how we run the operations. We can scale it down a bit or we can scale it up. From our experience, it's actually sometimes, of course, easier if you maintain a certain moderate stance where your operations are concerned. Even if you have a little bit extra, you don't actually totally maximize the utilization of the funds, until and unless you're sure that there's another funding line coming in to make it sustainable. In a situation like Cox's Bazaar, where the end is not certain, it's different, of course, if it's a short-term healthcare or water sanitation program in an acute natural disaster situation. In Cox's Bazaar, we will need at least 500,000 ringgit, Malaysia, if we were to scale down the clinics,
And this is a month, a year?
A year for one clinic. So we have two now, so that means 1 million ringgit.
Mm-hmm.
Now that is, we scale it down, meaning we do primary care, we scale down the maternal and child health portion. We don't, for example, attempt to do any deliveries. We send all potential deliveries out, except if they are an emergency. As well as we probably cut down on our health education and immunization programs. Now, if we were to scale up, it would then be anything between 1 million to 1.5 million, 1.5 million ringgit a year for one clinic. That is being conservative.
Mm.
And this is where, if we were to sustain it beyond 2020, we'll need a new injection of funds.
I'm speaking to Dr. Ahmad Faizal Mohamed Perdaus, President of Mercy Malaysia, here on this extended edition of The Breakfast Grill. After the news, stay tuned as we continue this discussion with a look into Mercy Malaysia's charitable funds and sustainable income. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to this extended edition of The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Dr. Ahmad Faizal Mohamed Perdaus, President of Mercy Malaysia. Now, Dato, you have done some very good work in terms of reducing your operational expenditure, because it was over 3 million just a couple of years ago, and you've slashed it now to 1.3 million, I think, in 2018. But earlier, Dato, you mentioned that in the face of a lack of unrestricted funds, when you send in a team into an immediate emergency relief situation, you have to call upon your reserves.
Yeah.
How far can those reserves take you? Because, for example, in 2016, Mercy Malaysia Asia did operate at a deficit of over 9 million ringgit, and that was almost equal to the amount of donation income that you pulled in for that year. What was the reason for that, and how far is it eating into what reserves that you have as an organization?
when we make those decisions, of course, we already have projected income streams also, yeah, mm-hmm. and we calculate how much we can spend in advance. And so then it's usually made up towards the end of the year or in the next year. But yes, you're right. Without more unrestricted funds, if there is a major emergency, especially if there are two or three major emergencies happening in the same year, without unrestricted funds, we will start spending first. Mm. We have no choice because we are committed to do so. And of course, we don't go overboard as well. But even without going overboard, especially operations overseas, they can quickly, very, very quickly run up the figures. And the thing about the income streams is that while what people don't realize also is that while donations are coming in, most of the donations, even in acute natural disaster situations, are pledges. Mm. Pledges take time to actually materialize in real cash. And it's not uncommon for the pledges to be realized only 6 months later. And this is where you get the deficit happening if there are two or three major emergencies happening at the same time. So thankfully, we've been able to manage that because how we do it is that in the good years, for example, in the 2014, 2015, those are the years then that we don't spend them all. We usually stagger the spending, yeah, over a period, say 2 or 3 years. So that helps cover the expenses that will come in for another emergency the next year if it's not such a good year. So generally speaking, that's how we cope. This is why this pattern of dependency on events and catastrophes happening has to end for us to be more sustainable. Restricted funds are fine to a large extent, but having more unrestricted funds will allow us more flexibility when responding and also, like I said, sustain and maintain our organisation internally.
But even taking into account these restricted funds, overall, your charitable fund balance as of last year is at its lowest point in easily the last 10 years. You've only got about 7.6 million left in that fund balance. Is this a cause for alarm? What is Mercy Malaysia doing to address this?
This is, again, because we, again, rely a lot on the disasters happening. So 16, 17 and 18, 3 years in a row, there's been no major acute natural disasters. This has affected the income coming in as opposed to the expenditure in the field that continues.
Right.
Most of our operations now over the last 2 years are mainly to do with refugees as well as with displaced people due to conflicts. The responses in Indonesia over the last 2 years have been mainly to moderate-sized earthquakes, which have brought in a limited amount of funds. And not as large as, say, a major or mega earthquake would. We are still okay simply because it means that when the money doesn't come in, there's no major natural disaster. It means there's no expenditure as well. So we are not spending anything. But yes, in the books, it will look like we have less. This is a challenge for us, and we need to move away from being dependent on just charitable funding. Which is why we are also in the midst at the moment of setting up a for-profit arm, which will allow us to generate income in years that are quiet, relatively quiet, like 16, 17 and 18, to then be able to generate income outside of the not-for-profit ambit.
And when can we expect that for-profit arm to materialise?
This Humanitarian Development Centre, as we call it, is already registered as a company by limited guarantee. It has its own sets of rules to comply with, both with ROS as well as with income tax laws to allow us to still enjoy tax-exempt status for contributions made. We should be seeing its rolling out formally either in December or January. So we're taking a little bit of time because we want to be very careful about it.
Right.
We need to ensure that, for example, stakeholders, including our partners and the general public, understand that we, Mercy Malaysia, remain a not-for-profit organisation. We remain a humanitarian relief organisation. We remain an organisation which uses volunteers to a large extent. And we instill the spirit of volunteerism. However, we are at a stage of our development and the juncture of our organisational growth and also the growth in the sector and the demands in the sector, that we can no longer just depend on charitable funding and on funding that is specific, restricted to especially to acute natural disasters. we need to move away. And apart from unrestricted funds, convincing people to give in a continuous daily manner, like the Seringgit Sehari program, we also need to move into for-profit avenues, yeah, which we can do well without impairing or having any adverse effect on our humanitarian principles. And we will maintain a very, very strict and separate oversight on the for-profit arm, yes.
But speaking of sustainable sources of income, aside from your for-profit arm, which you're in the midst of setting up, other ways to raise money in a more sustainable manner? For example, have you considered going down the path of maybe creating an endowment fund or perhaps taking advantage of the fact that Khazanah National issues social impact bonds? So if you pitched your projects to impact investors or to be a beneficiary of social impact bonds, that could be another source of sustainable income for Mercy, right?
Definitely. And we have, since you mentioned Khazanah, Khazanah has been our one of our main supporters for the last 15 years out of the 20. They stopped that about 10 years ago because they felt that we had reached a certain level of independence and financial stability.
Do you think they'll recommence that funding anytime soon?
No. We have it from them that they think we're good enough to be on our own. And yes, we have talked to them seriously about social impact bonds, etc. Their first issuance of their social impact bonds was very much targeted to the Malaysian education sector, and so there was no room for at that time for Mercy Malaysia or organizations like ours. We have been talking to them and others about social impact bonds. We even pitched at several Islamic finance conferences, as well as with the Securities Commission, has helped us as well in pitching this idea. There is this issue of with humanitarian impact bonds, especially in a country like Malaysia, which is not yet a humanitarian donor country, yeah? As to who is to underwrite the bonds, basically. Whereas Khazanah's first education bond, for example, had a very stable and very definite target, which was the Malaysian education sector, which is fully supported by the Malaysian government and fully accepted by stakeholders. It is a bit tougher to get the same level of support for a humanitarian endeavour, especially one like Mercy Malaysia's. In a country where it is not yet the norm. With regards to endowment funds, we have been talking, in particular to a few of the zakat bodies and a few philanthropic foundations, work in progress. Again, they need to see the rationale and the reasoning behind it before they can actually commit. Yes, an endowment fund is very much also in the works. We have not yet been able to confirm, though. The particular zakat body, that which I cannot mention here, which we have been talking to, has expressed real interest, but needs to see on a longer term basis how it would actually benefit also the people whom they have to serve. So let's put it that way. So there is some discussion still on that particular point.
And Dato, Mercy Malaysia is also running a humanitarian conference at this point. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that, since it is ongoing today.
Yes, thank you very much, Lynn. We actually are in the midst of our International Humanitarian Conference. This is the third time Mercy Malaysia will be having one. This is by far the biggest. And I would dare say this year, at least, it is probably the biggest humanitarian conference in Malaysia. It is happening at Sunway University. We thank the Sunway Group for being gracious enough to be our host and partner for this. As far as I know, there are still places available if people are interested. I would encourage anyone because there are many, many areas that we touch upon. We have four main pillars, which are medical and health. We have conflicts and refugees. We have disaster risk reduction and resilient communities. And we have social inclusion. And on top of that, we have technical and water sanitation and rebuilding as well. And we have two or three cross-cutting themes. Among them are humanitarian leadership, humanitarian financing, which we've just discussed at length, as well as areas related to localization and the utilization of local partners and local humanitarian assets. So these are some of the areas which we will be touching upon. And we hope that people will not only get to gain knowledge, but also enjoy the conference.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Dato. I'm speaking with Dato Faizal Mohamed Perdaus, President of Mercy Malaysia. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan's Malaysia Mobile Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.